Hello everyone and welcome into the Mob Files. Today's episode is going to be a little bit different than our previous ones. Our episodes up until now have focused on a particular mobster or a specific mob family. But today what we're going to be doing is taking a look at some mafia hits. This will be an ongoing series, so this is part one. Stay tuned for the other parts. Violence is obviously a central piece of mob life. Mobsters and associates have been killed for all sorts of reasons. Maybe they snitched, disobeyed orders, or just disrespected the wrong person. But our focus in this series is going to be on hits that took place for strategic reasons. Hits for the purpose of gaining more power in a family, or in the mob world in general. With that in mind, it should come as no surprise that all four of the hits we're going to go over today were on active bosses, either official or in an acting capacity. First, we'll discuss the murder of Big Paul Castellano, who was boss of the Gambino family. Next up is Charles Bonaggio, who was boss of the Kansas City crime family when he was taken out. The third hit is the murder of Carmine Galante, who was boss of the Bonanno crime family. And the last one we're going to talk about today is Ignacio Antonori, who was the boss of the Tampa crime family when he was murdered. I'm sure most people have heard a lot about Paul Castellano and Carmine Galante. They're very famous gangsters from the Five Families. Lots out there on them. But Antonori and Bonaggio may not be quite as well known. They are both somewhat overshadowed by heavyweights that led their respective families after they were out of the picture. Santo Traficante Jr. in Tampa and Nick Savella in Kansas City. Maybe you have heard of them, I don't know. Either way, we have a lot to cover, so let's dive in. Alright, starting here with Big Paul Castellano. Castellano is a towering figure in mob history, and not just because he was tall, but also because of the life that he led. He took over the Gambino family directly after Carlo Gambino in 1976. He was selected thanks to his business skills. Gambino believed that the family would be more successful if it started to push into legitimate business, and that's really where Castellano's expertise laid. And Gambino was correct in his prediction. The family thrived financially under the leadership of Castellano. He built up the family's involvement in a number of businesses and moved them into what he believed to be safer areas of crime. That's, of course, relatively speaking, but money laundering and things like that, where they could be a little bit more hands-off. He also forged relationships with outside groups to help expand the family's powers. I will definitely do an episode on Castellano soon, but today I'm just going to focus on the events that led to his downfall. As I said, Castellano was a businessman first and foremost. This meant that a lot of the street-level soldiers didn't respect him. In their eyes, he did not have the proper experience on the street to be calling the shots there. He also apparently wasn't very approachable. He preferred to stay holed up in his Staten Island mansion, passing down orders through a select number of captains that would come and visit him. Castellano's house or mansion leads me to the next issue. He was viewed as greedy by some of the men. He increased his take on various rackets and built a 17-bedroom mansion, while at the same time prohibiting his guys from taking part in the drug trade where they could have made a lot of money. All of these factors, and of course I'm sure there were many more, led to John Gotti, who was a powerful captain in the family, having issues with Big Paul. Castellano had also made several decisions that hurt Gotti financially. Again, he banned the dealing of drugs and was taking a bigger cut off of rackets than Gotti thought was fair. Things reached a boiling point, and Gotti started to lay the groundwork to take out Castellano. Gotti reached out to other captains and high-level soldiers who were also upset with Castellano's leadership. This includes, of course, Sammy the Bull Gravano. Generally speaking, a hit on the boss of a family had to be approved by the Mafia Commission. Gotti knew this wasn't going to happen due to Castellano's relationships with the other New York families. Instead, he made sure he had the backing of certain high-ranking members within the Colombo, Bonanno, and Lucchese families. He knew that the Genovese were out of the question because Castellano had a very strong relationship with that family. Eventually, Gotti built up enough support for the hit that he felt that he was safe to proceed. He received word that Castellano would be dining at Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan on December 16, 1985. As Gotti watched from his car, Castellano was gunned down by Gotti's hitman as he got out of his vehicle at the restaurant. Despite it being well known that Gotti was behind the hit, he was formally announced as the new boss of the family just a short time later in January 1986. Alright, our next hit is the murder of Charles Bonaggio in 1950. At the time of his murder, Bonaggio was the boss of the Kansas City crime family. He was actually born in Texas in 1909, but he moved to Kansas City when he was very young. He grew up on the north side in Kansas City, which at that time was heavily populated by Italian families. He started to gain his power during the Prohibition era. He was a key player in the bootlegging industry in the city. Towards the end of the 1920s, John Lazzia became the top dog in Kansas City. Lazzia had a lot of political power and served as the leader of the Northside Democratic Club in the city. He operated a number of legitimate businesses, but was also heavily involved in gambling, loan sharking, and other rackets, again relying on his political connections to make sure the right people looked the other way. Lazzia took a liking to Bonaggio, which put Bonaggio on the fast track to a powerful position. John Lazzia was killed in 1934. Bonaggio didn't get the top job, but he was promoted to underboss. Charles Carollo was promoted to boss at that time. But Bonaggio did take over the family at some point in the not-too-distant future. Bonaggio helped the Kansas City family expand their operations in drug trafficking and gambling, and the 30s were a very profitable time for the family. Things did not go as well in the 1940s. Control of the Kansas City Police Department had been shifted to a board of commissioners appointed by the governor. This was due to rampant corruption in the department. Fun fact, the department is still controlled by the state board today, and this is a hot-button issue that comes up frequently in Kansas City. Now, I'm not just talking out my ass on that one, I lived there for about 4 years. Bonaggio was unable to get his stooges appointed to the board, and the Kansas City Police Department went from being very friendly to gambling, or at least very willing to look the other way, to totally opposing it and cracking down on it. This obviously cut into the family's profit, and to make matters worse for Bonaggio, he had run afoul of powerful mobsters primarily in Chicago. On April 5, 1950, Bonaggio and his underboss Charles Gargatta arrived at the First Ward Democratic Club in Kansas City, presumably for a meeting. Early the next morning, a cab driver noticed that the door to the club was open and he called the police. Kansas City police arrived and found both of the Charleses dead. They had been shot with .32 caliber revolvers. Charles Bonaggio was only 41 years old. Now, an interesting fact about this murder is that there's a famous picture of Charles Gargatta laying on the ground after he had been killed at the Democratic Club. And in the background, looking over him, is a giant picture of Harry Truman, who of course got his political start in Kansas City. The most prominent theory behind the murder points the fingers at Anthony Gizzo, who was a high-ranking figure in the Kansas City family. Because Bonaggio was the boss of the family, it is almost certain that the hit was either ordered or approved by the Mafia Commission. And Gizzo did stand to benefit from Bonaggio's downfall. He took over the family after Bonaggio was out of the picture. Alright, our next hit is Carmine Galante. Galante was murdered in 1979. Again, Carmine Galante is a figure who definitely deserves his own episode, but for the purposes of today, I'm just going to provide a very high-level overview. He was born in 1910 in Manhattan. He became involved with crime very early on, even as compared to his mafia counterparts, apparently before he was 10 years old, and things escalated quickly from there. He eventually became a hitman for Vito Genovese and was suspected of being involved with dozens of murders. Galante later became involved with the Bonanno family. By the late 50s, he was elevated to the rank of consigliere. In 1962, he hit a snag and was convicted on drug charges and sentenced to 20 years in prison. But he got out early on parole in 1974 and resumed his mob activities. With the boss of the family, Rusty Rastelli, headed to prison, Galante became the unofficial acting boss of the Bonanno crime family. In 1978, Galante was sent back to prison for violating his parole by associating with known criminals. That's hard to avoid for a mob boss. Lucky for him, a judge found that the government had acted inappropriately and ordered his release in 1979. Backtracking a bit here, when Galante took control of the family, he made a strong push to take over large amounts of drug trafficking territory in New York City. This includes sanctioning a lot of hits on Gambino crime family members to try to reach that goal. The other families in New York obviously didn't like what Galante was doing. Frank Thierry, in particular, who was the boss of the Genovese family at that time, led the push to have Galante taken out. It's important to note that Galante was still just the acting boss at that time. Rusty Rastelli was still the official boss even though he was in prison. he signed off on the hit, and amazingly, Joe Bonanno himself, who had moved into retirement at that point, gave the okay as well. The approval of those two mob heavyweights gave Thierry a lot of cover. The commission approved the hit in 1979, and with that, Galante's fate was sealed. On July 12, 1979, Galante was eating lunch on the patio at Joe and Mary's Italian-American restaurant in Brooklyn. He was joined by Leonard Coppola, a loyal captain, as well as another loyal soldier and his two bodyguards. Three gunmen came onto the patio through the restaurant and opened fire. Galante and the other two mobsters were killed. The bodyguards, who didn't do anything to protect Galante apparently, were spared. Carmine Galante was 69 years old at the time of his murder. There is a now very famous photo of Galante after the hit. He's laying on the patio of that restaurant with the cigar still in his mouth. After Galante's death, and remember, Rastilli was still the official boss while he was in prison, the family ran through several acting bosses before Joseph Massino took over as boss in 1991 and provided stability for the family, at least until he flipped and started working for the government. Okay, the last hit we're going to cover today is the murder of Tampa crime family boss Ignacio Antinori in 1940. I mentioned Antinori briefly in the Santo Trafficante Jr. episode, but I want to provide a little bit more background info on him here. Antinori was born in Sicily in 1885. At some point, he made his way to Tampa, Florida. Antinori gained enormous amounts of power and influence during the 20s and 30s. He was heavily involved in the drug trade, importing the product from Cuba and distributing throughout the United States, not just in Florida, but reaching out all the way to the Midwest, with where he relied on his connections in Kansas City and St. Louis. Antinori was the first boss of the Tampa crime family, but he's not the name that people associate with the mob in Tampa. That title belongs, of course, to the Trafficantes. Santo Trafficante Jr. is widely considered one of the most powerful mob bosses in history. But the groundwork for his rise to power was laid by his father, Santo Trafficante Sr. Santo Sr. was around the same age as Antinori, and they coexisted in Tampa for a long time. They even worked together to expand the family's operations out into the state further. But Santo Sr. continued to gain power and eventually became a clear threat to Antinori. He was just getting too powerful. And of course, Trafficante had strong connections with mobsters in New York City, which gave him a leg up in the competition. But it's important to know that Antinori had other threats to keep his eyes on as well. The 1930s in Tampa are referred to as the Era of Blood. Antinori and the Tampa family were at war with Charlie Wall's organization. Wall was a very interesting character. His father was the former mayor of Tampa, and his mother came from a prominent family as well. Despite all of that, Wall entered into the criminal life. He used his political connections to build a massive gambling operation, paying bribes to keep the government off of his back. Wall's organization consisted of Italians, Cubans, really anybody who would help him make money. There were a lot of hits on both sides of the war during the 30s, but the big three of Antinori, Trafficante, and Wall all survived the era. But Antinori's days were numbered. On October 22, 1940, he was drinking coffee with a few friends at the Palm Garden Inn in Tampa. A gunman managed to sneak up on the group and open fire with a sawed-off shotgun. Antinori was killed instantly. He was 55 years old. Your first guess at who was responsible would probably be Wall or maybe Trafficante. They obviously would have the most to gain by taking out Antinori. However, it's believed that the hit was actually ordered due to a business dispute with outside influences. Specifically, the Chicago outfit was upset with the quality of drugs they had received from Tampa and tried to get Antinori to address the issue. He refused to cooperate and, well, we already covered what happened. Wall may have survived the war with Antinori, but his organization was greatly weakened during this period as well. As a result, Santo Trafficante Sr. was able to seize power in Tampa, and the Trafficante family didn't give up this power up until Santo Jr.'s death in 1987. Alright, that wraps up Mob Hits Part 1. Be on the lookout for Part 2. Next week, we'll probably go back to the traditional format with the focus on a particular mobster or family, but Part 2 of the series is already in the works, and it'll be coming soon. Thank you for listening to Episode 11 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed, be sure to subscribe or follow, and please leave a review on your listening platform of choice. Thanks again, and have a great day.